Welcome, baseball family. This week we have the Met City Connects. Boone got ejected again, and we have an interview with author Keith O'Brien of Charlie Hustle right now.
Nine Plus Us presents the Baseball Together podcast with your hosts, Blackjack Brad and Kansas City Little Big Briggy Blue Eyes. And now, Baseball Together.
Welcome, baseball family, to this week's episode of the Baseball Together podcast. My name is Brad, and I am flying solo this week. Mr. Brigg decided it would be a good idea to go with his fiance down to somewhere down in South Florida, Keys, something like that. I don't know why he didn't take me with him, and he decided it would be a good idea to take his fiance instead. But whatever, here we are. I'm here. I'm going to do the show by myself this week, and we'll deal with that at another day. Anyway. There's some fun stuff to get into. We had a fantastic interview with an author, Keith O'Brien. He wrote a book about Pete Rose called Charlie Hustle. I highly recommend it. We'll get in more into that later as we talk to him in our interview. But first things first, let's talk about the Mets City Connect uniforms. Okay, there's a lot going on here because initially I felt like they were very plain. Right? Surface level, you're like, man, that a lot of people were saying wannabe road Yankees uniform. Okay. Not necessarily the case. There's a lot more going on here than what we see at surface level. We just see a gray and black uniform. That's it. Okay. So everything on this uniform, just like everything else, everything has significance. So first things first, the gray represents the concrete jungle that is New York. Okay, there's gray all over this thing, the gray hat, the gray jersey. There's gray underneath the visor, as Brigg would say. Across the chest, you've got NYC instead of Queens, instead of New York. You've got NYC representing all five boroughs across New York. I thought that was an interesting choice, not just representing Queens where the Mets play, right? Instead, they want to represent all of New York. You can see on the swish on the right shoulder there, that's purple. There are several purple accents throughout. The squatchy on top of the hat is purple. And then I'll get to a little bit more purple later. But that represents the 7 subway line that stops at Citi Field, which I thought was an interesting little touch. There's a lot of stuff about the subway in here. So there's also a patch on the left sleeve. I couldn't find a good standalone picture of it. But that represents, it's supposed to be like a subway token. The pinstripes on these things are actually made from circles and diamonds representing the subway lines in New York. I've never been to New York. I'm not familiar with the New York subway system and all that, all the intricacies that come with it. My understanding or familiarity with the New York subway system is very, no pun intended, surface level, basically based on what I've seen in the movies, right? So, 'cause, like I said, never been. But then you do get into Queens a little bit. You can't see it here, and I couldn't find a good picture of it. But the cuffs, you can see a little bit there that the cuff has a little bit different texture on the sleeve. It actually has the trusses from the Queensboro Bridge, which I think is pretty cool. So again, talking a little bit about the Queensboro Bridge, let's get a close-up of the hat. Okay, there we have it. It's the classic New York Mets NY. I like that they stuck with that. That's pretty cool. But underneath it and across the front two panels of the hat, you can see is the Queensboro Bridge again. So that's a pretty neat touch to make it specifically towards the borough where the Mets play. There you can see the purple squatchy on top of the hat. And again, another one I couldn't find a good picture of is more purple down on the jock tag, just above the jock tag. It says the World City. This was a cool touch that I liked a lot. Here inside, kind of the sweatband inside the hat, it's an artistic visual of the New York City subway system, which I thought was pretty neat. That looks really cool. I would have liked to have had that a little bit more visible because I think it's neat. I think it's great. And then you've got concrete again on the under visor of the hat there. That looks really cool. So some interesting things about these jerseys. This whole uniform took 2 years to design. They had 30 variations. And then eventually, finally, Francisco Lindor and Brandon Nimmo were the ones who signed off on this final design. So if you have a problem with it, take it up with those guys, right? Because they're the ones who said, yes, this is the one. We like it. specifically the Mets will wear these uniforms every Saturday home game. And the first one will be this Saturday, April the 27th. And then every home game on Saturday through the rest of the season, they will be wearing their City Connect uniforms. That goes a little bit different from what other teams have done. Like I know the Mariners and I believe the Rockies and I think the Phillies all wear theirs on Friday nights. I know for a fact the Mariners do because I watch those games every week, every other week, I guess. But anyway, so there's the, that's the Mets City Connect uniform. I have some thoughts about this. I like it. I think it looks cool. The black, basically what ends up being a black pinstripe against a gray jersey, looks cool. My only problem with that is that they're wearing white pants with them. Pinstripe tops, solid bottoms, do not look super sharp in my opinion. I love pinstripes, don't get me wrong. But I feel like they got it backwards. They needed to have matching pinstripe pants to go with these jerseys. I'm fine with pinstripe pants and solid colored tops. Absolutely okay with that. I think that looks good. There are several teams. The Yankees, I know the Cubs do it in spring training, and I'm sure that the Phillies do it in spring training as well. You know, all the teams that wear pinstripes, they'll go solid top time and again during spring training. I think it looks great. I've worn a uniform like that. Pinstripe bottoms, solid top. Loved it. Wasn't sure about it at first, but put it on. Loved every bit of it. But I don't think you can go in reverse. it's just a little awkward to me. I don't know. Anyway, that's just me. Let me know what you think about these City Connects, though. I know that City Connect uniforms are always met with mixed reviews. You pretty much love them or you hate them. There's not a whole lot in between. I feel like I'm a little bit in between on this. I think they're going to grow on me. I think they'll probably look better on the field because they typically do, right? So every once in a while we get one, we're like, oh, no, that doesn't look good on the field either. But for the most part, they're going to look a lot better on the field than they do in those studio photos. Okay, we have a few significant injuries here. Some injury updates for you. Just a few, not very many. The Diamondbacks' Merrill Kelly pictured here. He's out with a teres major strain in his shoulder. The teres major is the muscle that basically it connects your goes from your shoulder blade, like your scapula, over to your humerus, the back of your arm. I don't want to say it's a big muscle, but it's a part of a significant muscle group in your back and in your shoulder. So they didn't say what grade strain that was. But he could be out for a little while because that could be a problem that he could deal with. It's going to make it hard for him to throw because I'm obviously as a pitcher, that's how he's going to have sustained that injury. But for the Diamondbacks, it's a good thing Jordan Montgomery's back because this could be a significant hole in the starting rotation for the Diamondbacks. And obviously Jordan Montgomery is the man in that rotation now. But it hurts them to have that hole of Merrill Kelly. The Angels' Anthony Rendon, he's going to be out with a hamstring injury. He was legging out a single in the series against the Reds. First batter of the game, he's leading it off, and he got hurt. So this one, I think we're going to see him out for a while. A hamstring can be a tricky thing, whether you like baseball or not, right? Even if you want to come back quickly and play, a hamstring is a thing you've got to be really careful with because you can injure it again really easily. So I think Rendon's, I don't want to say he's going to milk it, but I think it's going to be a while before we see him on the field again because this is a significant injury. The Astros, their pitching has been decimated with injuries. Christian Javier was put on the IL with a neck injury. They said it was neck discomfort. I don't want to say just neck discomfort, but it was neck discomfort, which can be a really irritating and uncomfortable thing to deal with, especially as a pitcher where you're looking sideways a lot of the time, right? So not something you want. But this makes Christian Javier, Luis Garcia, Lance McCullers, Jose Urquidy, and Framber Valdez all out for the Astros. There's a reason this team is in the basement of the AL West right now. They have no pitching. They're all out. These guys are all injured. So I guess if you play enough postseason games, eventually maybe he'll catch up to you. I don't know. But anyway, they got Justin Verlander back, so they do have some pitching. But man, I don't think Verlander can carry this whole thing by himself, because even if you're only winning his starts, you're only winning one out of every 5 days, right? So it's too bad for Christian Javier. He really came into his own, had a great year last year, and I'm sure he was counting on having a good one this year. Last one, the Tampa Bay Rays, Pete Fairbanks, their closer, he's out with a nerve-related issue in his hand. He kind of got lit up the other day and said that he wasn't really sure what was, besides everything being crappy, he wasn't really sure what was going on, but I think this is probably what was going on, is a nerve-related issue in his hand. Kevin Cash, the manager, said that they're going to run imaging from his neck to his shoulder all the way down to his fingers to try to figure out what's going on. He has some tingling. That can't be comfortable or good. I imagine I didn't do well in the nervous system unit and in my anatomy physiology classes, but to me that doesn't seem like a good thing. So hopefully he gets it sorted out and can get back. Last year, the Mariners, Marco Gonzalez, now he's a Pirate, but at the time he was a Mariner, he had some nerve issues and ended up missing probably 2/3 of the season, I think, if I remember right. He went out with a forearm strain, ended up having nerve issues and missed the rest of the season. So I really hope it's not a big one for him, because that'd be a bummer. This happened today on Monday, and it was actually pretty funny. Just the comedy of errors of this whole thing. Aaron Boone got ejected yet again, right? Boone is always doing something to get tossed. He's always chirping. Guys in his dugout are chirping, getting him tossed. Well, this time it was a fan. 5 pitches into the game, Aaron Boone was given a warning. Umpire Hunter Wendelstead said, "Got anything else to say? You're gone." That was his warning. 5 pitches into the game. The fan sitting directly behind the dugout said something Wendelstead didn't like, and Boone got tossed for it. And it's funny because they showed the replay. You can see the guy sitting there. He said, "Let's go." I think he said, "Let's go home plate." Was what it looked like he said. And apparently he didn't like that. And so he looked at Boone and he tossed him. Boone and bench coach Brad Ausmus, they were adamant that the fan had said something. Like I said, you could see it on the replay. And Wendelstead's response was, "I don't care who said it. You're out of here." And I think later he said something that he heard something coming from the end of the dugout. And that was what it was. And he had warned Aaron Boone that anything coming from the dugout was going to be a problem for him. So, yeah, he said, "Aaron Boone is the manager of the New York Yankees and is responsible for everything that happens in that dugout. I don't want to eject a ball player. We need to keep them in the game. That's what the fans pay to see. Aaron Boone runs the Yankees. He got ejected." Then he continues and he said, "Apparently what he said was there is a fan right above the dugout. This isn't my first ejection. In the entirety of my career, I have never ejected a player or a manager for something a fan said. I understand that that's going to be part of a story or something like that, because that's what Aaron was portraying. I heard something come from the far end of the dugout. Had nothing to do with his area, but he's the manager of the Yankees, so he's the one who had to go." Wow. Okay, so this to me is just absolutely absurd. And he can make this up, right? And then even if the Yankees say nobody at the other end of the dugout said a word, even if that is their side of the story and that's what's true, this is what the umpire can say. He could say, "I heard something from the end of the dugout," right? That can be his excuse, his scapegoat for this whole thing. And there's not going to be any accountability for this at all, because umpires are not held accountable by Major League Baseball. They're held accountable in the court of public opinion, thanks to umpire auditor, umpire scorecards, instant replay, and things like that. We have all those things at our disposal to hold umpires accountable. Unfortunately, it doesn't do any good in Major League Baseball. Why? This is something I heard on Foul Territory. This is explained by AJ Brzezinski. He said, "Umpires cannot get fired because of their current CBA. They cannot get fired or demoted. They agreed to not take pay raises during this collective bargaining agreement in exchange for not getting fired or demoted." This is why we continue to see Angel Hernandez just being an absolute clown behind the plate and on the field every single day. Things like this from Hunter Wendelstedt, who, oh, I heard something down at the end of the dugout. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Either way, he ejected Aaron Boone for something that most likely a fan said. Okay. I spoke to a guy who used to be, I think he was a big league umpire. Either way, he was a regional umpire supervisor in the minor leagues. Umpired lots of games, right? I'm pretty sure he made it to the big leagues for a little while. Lots of minor league, international even. We asked him, can you hear hecklers in the stands? And he said, minor league stadiums? Yeah, there's not very many people there. Usually you can hear all that. International, typically, but I couldn't understand him. I didn't speak Spanish. However, the one thing he did say was you get to the big leagues and you can't hear what the fans are saying. There's too many people there. But this one, the shotgun mic that I think was the Yes Network that I was watching had, they clearly picked up Aaron Boone on the field. They picked up Wendelstedt responding and yelling at Boone. They didn't pick up the fan, though. So I don't know. Anyway, it's an odd thing to me that these umpires cannot and will not be held accountable by Major League Baseball because the owners are cheap and the league is suffering because of it. We have things like this to talk about every single day because something is going on. It's just absurd. It is absolutely absurd. They need to fix it the next time they have to negotiate a CBA. So Trevor Bauer is making history in the Mexican League. Okay. This weekend, he pitched 5 innings. He tossed 14 strikeouts, 9 in a row. So he went all the way through the order and struck everybody out. At one point, he threw 12 consecutive strikes, and during that time, threw an immaculate inning. So we've talked about this ad nauseum at this point. He's making it really hard for big league teams to not bring him in. There are teams that are trotting out guys who are nowhere near the quality of Trevor Bauer. Every single day, all 5 guys in their rotation. 5 days a week, over and over and over again, they're bringing out a different starting pitcher who is not at this level. I don't know. You know, other than his, obviously, you know, there might be more cases outstanding that we don't know. I had forgotten about the Lindsey Hill thing. That was one thing that had been brought up. But now that that's cleared, is there a third case that's outstanding? And if there is that when he finally gets signed? Because, I mean, we see this every week. There are guys who have been in the league, who have stayed in the league, continued to be in the league, who have been convicted of crimes far worse than Bauer's, and remain in the league. Trevor Bauer has never been convicted of anything. The only real problem he's had is eyeballs. Because that's not a good look, I'll be honest. A bunch of women coming forward and saying, this is what happened. But the fact that he has not been convicted of anything helps him in this case. I know that Major League Baseball doesn't love him because he has no problem being the villain. He has no problem going out there and doing the sword, doing the Conor McGregor strut, whatever that thing is, right? And trying to get on people's bad side because he's the villain. He wants eyeballs on baseball, though. That's why he's doing this. He's encouraging storylines like, oh, if he's pitching for the Dodgers and then he's saying something about the Astros cheating scandal, ooh, what's going to happen when the Dodgers play the Astros? Is somebody going to hit a line drive back up the middle at Bauer? Is Bauer going to be able to strike those guys out? He's making storylines, and that's what baseball needs. He understands this. Baseball needs him in the game, honestly. It really does. And I feel like the good outweighs the bad as far as ratings, eyeballs, and I know it's hard to overcome the court of public perception, but if he continues to be found innocent of all these charges, I don't know why baseball can continue to not have him in the league. It just doesn't make any sense to me other than that. All right. The White Sox are off to a major league worst 3-18. 3 wins and 18 losses on the year. This is going into Monday. They are currently, actually, they're 3-19. They lost tonight. 3-19. It's just, it's absurd. It's so bad. Last year they were bad, but man, I feel like they are even worse this year. They have a minus 78 run differential. Not scoring runs, giving up a bunch of runs, but things got pretty bad this weekend against the Phillies. On Friday night, Spencer Turnbull, he took a no-hit bid into the seventh inning against the White Sox. And then on Saturday, Zach Wheeler took a no-hitter into the eighth inning, 7 1/3. I don't know why it is the White Sox are so bad. Because I was looking at their 40-man roster. We were at the Dodgers backfields. There was a ton of people there. You would think they had the Beatles, the way they had the like cornered off and stuff like that. No access to players. Couldn't get any autographs, which was fine. It makes sense. So we're like, you know, let's head over to the White Sox side. You can just walk right across to the White Sox side. There was nobody. So my son's standing there wanting to get autographs to players, and all these guys are walking by, and I'm looking up on the their 40-man roster. I'm like, they should be a lot better than this. They're not a 3-win team 20 games into the season. I don't know what's going on there besides just flat-out dysfunction and this team not being able to win. But, man, I don't know if there's some kind of toxicity than there very well could be, right? But it's brutal, and I feel bad for White Sox fans because it's ugly. It's really, really ugly, and it shouldn't be this bad in Chicago. They've got some talent on that team. It's crazy. It is just bananas to watch. Okay, so this is a thing that happened this weekend. My guy Julio, for those of you who might be new to the show or whatever, I am an unapologetic Mariners fan, hence the trident over my right shoulder. Love my Mariners. Love Julio Rodriguez. But Julio got what's called a toot bland this weekend, which stands for thrown out on the bases like a nincompoop. And he was. He absolutely was. I will own this 100%. The Julio got thrown out on the bases like a nincompoop. So, first off, Toot Bland, this was created by like a blogger or something like that, like 10 to 15 years ago. They kept track of this, and this is fun. There are others like this that I'll go through in just a minute that we're going to keep track of. But so, Julio's Toot Bland. This is the top of the seventh inning. The game is tied 0-0. The Mariners are playing in Colorado, playing the Rockies. Julio Rodriguez singles shortstop. J.P. Crawford somehow got tagged out at third base on an incredible play by Ryan McMahon. Like, I don't know how he got that tagged down, but I guess that's why he's a big leaguer, right? Because a lot of times we see guys making plays like, oh, pretty routine play. The thing that makes these guys elite defensively is making the kind of plays that Ryan McMahon made and the kind of play that Brendan Rodgers made. Here in just a minute, I'm going to show you this video. So, first off, Julio Rodriguez has been incredibly aggressive on the base paths lately, which is fine. I love it. I absolutely love it because he hasn't hit any home runs at heat, so he's making up for it, making stuff happen on the base paths. I've been fine with it until this happened. So what happened is he left early. Jake Bird stepped off the mound. Here it is. Here's the video. The catcher's pointing to it. Julio's going into second. He slides, gets tagged by Rodgers. That was a heck of a play. So initially, he called him out. Julio thought he was safe. Personally, I thought he was safe, but there wasn't enough evidence to overturn it. You can see right here, it's really, really close. Boom. Yeah, it's a bang-bang, which is the technical term, by the way, according to an umpire, a bang-bang play. But Brendan Rodgers went up and got that tag down. The Mariners challenged it. Julio thought he was safe. I thought he was safe, but not enough evidence to overturn it. Call and field stands. Julio is out. Gets himself a toot bland. Okay, like I said, we're going to be looking for more oddities like this because these are fun. Stuff like this is fun. Toot bland, it's a fun thing to say. It's a fun thing to look for. But what else we're going to be looking for is we're going to be looking for Noble Tigers. No outs, bases loaded, ending with team incapable of getting easy run. Every team has at least one Noble Tiger, I'm sure, by this point in the season already. Noble Tigers seem like they pop up all the time. And then the other one is a fart slam. A fart slam is a fielder allows run to score like a moron. So we will have one of, we'll try to find one of these every weekend to show and talk to you. But before we move on, I want to talk about, I wanted to look at umpire Chris Guccione. He is the second base umpire here. He just could not wait for somebody to get thrown out at second stealing. He just, look at this hop. Bow! Just ecstatic calling Julio out on that play. The hop when he throws his arm and emphatically calls him out at second. I saw that happen, and I laughed at the umpire, and then I was mad that he was called out. Anyway, let's get into our weekend sweeps. Okay, we had four sweeps this weekend. The Reds swept the Angels. This is a bounce-back series for the Reds after getting swept by the Mariners to start the week. I feel like it's a big series for them. I'm not super shocked that they came back and they swept the Angels, because the Angels just – they struggle, right? Perennially, they've been struggling lately. And the Reds are a good team, so they bounced back and did what they needed to do there. Cleveland swept the A's, took care of business, did what they needed to do. Cleveland, by the way, going into Monday, has the best record in Major League Baseball. That's right. Your Cleveland Guardians, I'm going to say it because they have the best record in baseball. It's 16-6 out of everybody. That's them. The Phillies swept the White Sox. Like I talked about, the White Sox are hapless for whatever reason this season. I can't figure out exactly what it is. And we knew they were going to be bad, but we didn't know they were going to be this bad. And then the Brewers swept the Cardinals. The Cardinals are not a great team. The Brewers, turns out, are a very good team. We didn't think that they would be because they made a lot of interesting moves. Turns out the sum of their parts has been really good so far early this season. Before we take a break, let's get into today in baseball history. Today in baseball, April 23rd, 1964, Houston Colt 45's pitcher Ken Johnson becomes the first pitcher ever to record the loss in a 9-inning no-hitter. Cincinnati's Pete Rose scored the only run of the game when second baseman Nellie Fox committed an error in the top of the 9th inning. So there's today, your today in baseball history for the day of the podcast release on Tuesday, April the 23rd. Well, baseball family, I'm going to take a quick break. When we get back, I'm going to have a previously recorded interview. You'll notice Brig is there as well. We talked to author Keith O'Brien. He wrote the book Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Welcome back, baseball family. We are thrilled to bring you this interview. We have Keith O'Brien with us. He is author of Charlie Hustle, the new book on Pete Rose. The subtitle is The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. It's available now. How are you, Keith?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're great.
We're ecstatic.
Yeah, awesome. We are.
Me too. Great to be here.
We're pumped to have you here. We, first of all, we love the book. Just absolutely have loved it. So Thank you for doing everything that it took to write the book. We're writers. We get it. And the amount of research that went into this book is apparent based on the notes and acknowledgments and all the research that you've annotated very clearly. So before we get into that later,
but Brick, go ahead and start us.
Yeah. We're going to get you caught in a rundown like we do with all our guests. All right. First question, what is your quest?
Wow. I'm a big fan of quests. It's actually the topic of all my books is a quest. My quest is honestly just be a good person, be a good dad, be a good spouse.
That's awesome.
I think we can wrap it up, Brig. I think that's it.
That
was outstanding.
We align with that.
Okay, I have a hard-hitting follow-up question. What is your favorite color?
My favorite color is purple.
Oh yeah.
It's going to be more common. I've noticed.
I'm going hard at purple, guys. I'm doing it.
Love it.
Yeah, I love purple. If your favorite team was a beverage, your favorite Major League Baseball team was a beverage, what would they be? And who is your favorite team?
Well, yeah. I'm born and raised in Cincinnati. And so the Reds are still my favorite team. In Cincinnati, if you're familiar with the city, there's a little place called United Dairy Farmers, UDF. And UDF is a place where you love to get a milkshake. And so I'll go milkshake.
Oh, nice.
Nice. I would have thought like something to do with Skyline Chili, but that's very obviously surface level of my understanding of Cincinnati. So
no. There's not a particular drink at Skyline
Chili. Yeah. I don't know that I'd want to drink it. So that's a good point. All right. Next question. If baseball was an ice cream flavor, what would it be?
Wow. You guys have good questions. baseball is, I think still for me, you know, America. I would say then if it's going to be the American ice cream, you just have to go vanilla or chocolate. You have to go one of the standards, I think. That's what I think.
Yeah. I feel like that's a response we get a lot. We get a lot of it's vanilla. There's nothing wrong with it. It's really, really good, but it's the classic, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't be like bubblegum ice cream. It wouldn't be, you know, it would have to be, I think, vanilla. Yeah. Although, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe Rocky Road, because, you know, baseball is, I don't know, is traveling on a rocky road, I would say, now.
It is right now, for sure.
Yeah.
Certainly. And it's not the last time, or it's not the first time, and it won't be the last time, for sure.
Right.
Correct. Yeah.
That's what your book's about, which I love. And then last question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Brad's favorite question.
Yeah, this is my tailor-made question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Brad always wants to ask people, do you think Babe Ruth is or is not overly romanticized?
Yeah. So it's like the old question, overrated, underrated, properly rated.
Right. Well, see, I don't want to say overrated, overly romanticized. Yeah. Right. I feel like there's a difference there.
This answer maybe will help inform our conversation here today. And certainly informed my reporting in my book about Pete Rose. I think we overly romanticize lots of athletes. I think that's a problem that we have as Americans, as fans. We like to think that we know them and we like to ascribe to them, you know, moral values and put them on pedestals. And, you know, at the end of the day, most of them are just really good at playing a kid's game, you know, and they have all the problems that anyone else has. So since that is just sort of my personal belief in general about athletes, I would say, yes, he's overly romanticized because nobody should be so romanticized to in the ways we've done for Babe Ruth and many others. What do you think?
My man. Yeah.
Brad loved that.
Absolutely. My thing is that the only thing we have of Babe Ruth is the old-timey radio call. The man was 8 feet tall and bulletproof. See, and he hits the ball 700 feet, 700 miles, you know, whatever. And it's like, it's not really how it was, but that's how they were conveying the story. And you had writers who were possibly embellishing what they saw because they had never seen anything like it to that point.
Right.
That's all we have to go off of. So that's my big thing with Babe Ruth being overly romanticized. So, and I mean, I'm here for it because I'd do the same thing, right?
Right.
That's how I am with Ellie De La Cruz and Shohei Ohtani and all those guys. So I get it. But at the same time, though, we got to have a little bit more realistic scope on things, I feel like. So
his numbers were so anomalous compared to the other guys he was playing with, you know. It would be like somebody coming in today and hitting, you know, 100 home runs, you know.
We would
go crazy for that today if some player showed up and suddenly was hitting 100. Right, so much more than anyone ever has. That would be a massive story. So, you know, his iconic status is earned, but I agree with you. It's overly romanticized, overly inflated, for sure.
Fantastic. Let's take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to get into the book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Mm-hmm. Welcome back, baseball family. So again, we have Keith O'Brien here with us. Again, the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Got it right here. You can get your copy on Amazon and really anywhere books are sold. Is that right?
Anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Anywhere. Awesome. And I would highly recommend it. And we're going to get into it and you'll find out why. So my first question for you, Keith, about this book, I'm curious how much like legwork it took to get this thing together, because it is thorough. There are a lot of extra notes, notations, everything that I was looking at the book. I was like, holy cow, this is huge. And then I was like, but the actual book itself is almost as big as the notes. So how much, like I said, how much legwork, how much research, and how long did it take to do all this?
Well, you know, about the notes, you know, I want to write a narrative. I want to tell a story. And try to bring nonfiction, you know, to life in maybe a novelistic kind of way. And so, you know, but I do take my work seriously as a journalist, as a historian, and I think it's important to show your reader how you know something. And so, you know, that's in the notes in the back of the book. If you're curious how you know how I, you know, painted a particular scene, you can find out there. But in the meantime, I'm not going to gum up the narrative with things that are going to slow it down. I want people to read and keep reading. You know, it took, I started my research for this book in the summer of 2021. Started my first interviews in August of 2021. Wow. And, you know, obviously, so it's, you know, 2.5 years from then to now. That included, you know, hundreds of hours of interviews with former players, with former commissioners of baseball, the entire team of men who pursued Pete in 1989 for his gambling, interviews with three different men who placed his bets on baseball, and 27 hours of interviews with Pete Rose himself until, you know, ultimately he did stop calling me back. So a lot of interviews, but also a lot of court records and documents as well, you know, were used to tell the story.
You touched on the fact that it is narrative. There is narrative drive behind the story. It is a story. It's a hell of a story, actually. And I think it's a story that stands on its own, which you do a good job of bringing to life, because the language is lyrical, but it moves fast. It has a literary flair, but without the literary sort of morass of slow literary, like in your head kind of feel. So how do you bridge the gap? Like what, how did you approach making it fast, but literary?
Oh, you know, there are some things that were very intentional. The chapters are relatively short. You know, you're not going to find a 30 page chapter in this book. You know, some chapters are 3 pages, you know, and so I think doing something like that can help quicken the pace, make it feel like you're moving quickly. And, you know, in any book, you can get lost in the weeds. You know, you can go down roads you shouldn't be going down. You can go off on a tangent you shouldn't be, you know, pursuing. That's certainly true with this. I mean, P. Rose, you know, played in thousands of baseball games. You know, there are millions of moments and scenes you could reconstruct for the book. So I was very choosy, you know, and very judicious in what I was going to write about. You know, and so I'm not going to cover every game or even every game in a World Series. You know, we're gonna get to the good parts, so to speak. And more importantly than that, you know, any moment that I did spend time on in the book, a game, a scene, a play, it has to move the story forward. It has to say something about Pete Rose. It has to say something about that season. It has to be crucial. Otherwise, we're just skipping ahead. And you know, you can, you know, summarize the game by saying, you know, the Reds proceeded to lose the next two games, you know, at Fenway or whatever, you know, and that's it. And we just covered two World Series games. But it was a challenge. It was a challenge because as a baseball fan, and I am a fan, you know, there's so many great moments. And so, you know, it hurt sometimes to not write about a moment, but my goal is to further the story, and I have to stay true to that goal.
Well, and that's why I brought it up, because I want our listeners and our viewers to know that the book is fast. Like, it, don't be intimidated by it, because it goes quick and it is richly written. So thanks for informing us on that.
Yeah, it really does. Well, awesome. One of the things, like you talk about the narrative, one of the things early on that Brig pointed out to me was, he's like, I would love to see this put together in like a kind of like a cinematic docuseries, kind of like Band of Brothers. Yeah. He's like, because I want to see that scene where Pete Rose is getting the crap beat out of him in that boxing match and see him get up.
Yep.
You know, stuff like that. Like your description, the way that you tell the story of how these things are going on, how these things are happening and unfolding, that it's just like, man, I could picture it in my head because of the way you describe it. And is that how you write that? Like, because that's the way I do it. As I picture a scene, and then as it unfolds, I kind of describe it on paper. Is that how you do it? Or do you have a different method to your madness?
No. Yeah. So knowing what scenes are important is crucial. You know, then doing all the reporting you can for a scene is crucial. That's something I actually haven't thought about, the boxing scene. You're right. That would be so cinematic. And it's funny. I never thought about it like that until you said it. But you know, that old armory that Pete was fighting in as a 16-year-old, you know, was just a classic sort of brick, you know, structure. It would have been dark in there. It would have been smoky in there. It would have been wild in there.
Yeah.
And yeah, to imagine this young Pete Rose, you know, getting beat up in the ring, but refusing to go down and taking that away from that fight, I think is a powerful scene. It also is a scene that, you know, Pete Rose has used to sort of gild the edges of his mythology, and Pete's really good at gilding the edges of his mythology. You know, he can turn, you know, a low point into a high point by saying, well, but what that shows is that I didn't quit. I didn't go down. And there's some truth in that, not to diminish Pete Rose. There's some truth in that. But he is really good at burnishing the mythology, and the press certainly helped a lot over the years too.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. That was my next question, was how do you work with somebody who is inherently biased? I won't call him unreliable, but there's
a borderline, right?
What?
But borderline, right?
Yeah. You know, I mean, he has an agenda, and his message is to, you know, paint himself in the best light possible. And I'm sure that those associated with him, there was more of that happening. So what do you do with that? How have you in this book bridged the gap between those gilded edges and the truth?
Well, let me say something. I do think Pete is an unreliable narrator of his own story. And I don't say that to be insulting. I just mean, this is a man who for 15 years, you know, lied and lied and lied about what happened. And I think in some ways is still diminishing what happened. So he is an unreliable narrator. I think most people are unreliable narrators. I think famous people in particular are. You know, if you are someone who's been interviewed thousands of times, you tend to go back to the same stories and the same version of that story. And so one of the challenges I presented for myself in interviewing Pete Rose was, let's go outside the lines. You know what I mean? I know the story he's going to tell me about, say, you know, the fight when he was a 16-year-old boy, or the 1970 All-Star Game slamming into Ray Fosse, or 1989 and the gambling allegations. You know, he's given enough interviews over the years. He's also written enough memoirs that I know what he's going to say. So, you know, one thing I was trying to do is to expand that a little bit. You know, sometimes the best questions to do that are just the shortest questions, you know, like, what do you mean? Or why? Or what happened next? You know, it's just short follow-ups. But getting to the why was really important. And that was part of my original pitch to Pete, that, you know, he's in his early 80s now. This is a time for reckoning, and that, you know, not everyone will support him. Not everyone will believe him potentially. But if he were to be vulnerable, if he were to let people into his darkness, maybe people would understand more. Maybe all of us would understand more. And that was part of my original pitch to Pete Rose.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah. How many of the people you interviewed did you find reluctant?
It varied. Some people were thrilled to talk, and it was like they had been waiting for someone to call. You know, but yeah, a lot of people were reluctant. There's a lot of pain in the Pete Rose story. You know, he if you cross paths with Pete Rose in a significant way, especially at the peak of his fame, 60s, 70s, and 80s, there is often a game, a play, an argument, a night that defines you 35, 40, 50 years later. Not just that defines Pete Rose. It's like if you got tangled up in that, you were often defined by that moment too. Wow. And those people still carry that with them. And so, you know, there was pain and, you know, reluctance at times to talk. And I have to say, you know, one thing I had going in my favor was, you know, this was a book. It wasn't a magazine story. I wasn't going to be working on it for 3 weeks. You know, I was doing reporting for like a year and a half. And there were several times where someone called me back months later, and was finally ready to talk.
Wow. And you got to be ready on the ball.
So was there anything in particular that was like the most shocking revelation to you that you learned when talking to these people, or even talking to Pete in particular? Is there anything that was just like, whoa, never heard that one before? That's crazy.
There were lots of surprising moments, lots of things that are in this book that have never been written about before. You know, so it's hard to summarize it in a sentence, but I think a lot of the stuff around the gambling is important and new. You know, Pete Rose doesn't get in trouble in 1989 for something that happens the year before or something that happened 6 weeks earlier. This is like a freight train of coming, and it's coming for 20 years. And so one of the things I wanted to do was go back and, you know, construct how, you know, his first bets with bookies and what that felt like for him, why he liked it, who those guys were, what he got out of that. And when you do that, you see that, you know, there are concerns about Pete Rose's gambling or his relationships as early as like 1975. Major League Baseball has concerns about his gambling as early as 1978. You know, people in his inner circle are quite concerned by the mid 1980s, and no one can stop him from gambling anymore. And you know, Pete Rose has earned all the criticism that he gets, you know, in particular for his lies, the lies that he told for many, many years. And you know, my book isn't about making a case for Pete Rose. It's not about making a case against Pete Rose. I'm writing this story, you know, without judgment. But I do think the addiction piece of this does matter. You know, in 1989, the idea that someone was a gambling addict was pretty far outside the common understanding of addiction for the everyday person. You know, we knew about alcoholism, we knew about drug addiction, but to be a gambling addict, that was pretty out there. And I think it's changed, you know, and as we've legalize gambling across America. We have a totally new relationship with gambling. And the idea that someone could be addicted to gambling is very common today. And I do think Pete's addiction, and that's what I would call it, is part of what put him in the corner that he couldn't get out of. You know, what does an addict do when they're confronted with the truth or with that, you know, with the problems that they're creating? They diminish and deny. That is well known. And in medical journals, and this isn't part of the book, but did help inform my understanding, in medical journals, time and again, there are two barriers to a gambling addict seeking help, not an alcoholic, not a drug addict, a gambling addict. And those two barriers are shame and indebtedness. Mm. And Pete is not the kind of person who's going to be vulnerable enough to ever admit that he felt shame. But I can tell you by the mid 1980s, he was in debt to bookies. Some of those debts were large. And I do believe that he felt shame about that.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that I've come to find over the last couple of years is that anybody who says that gambling can't be addictive or isn't addictive doesn't understand the drug that it can be. Right. And the other thing, like you talk about how Pete Rose wasn't going to have the shame, like anybody who plays a professional sport has such a massively inflated ego because there's a certain level you have to survive on the field. Right. Like I talked about this with Bryce Harper all the time. Like he's not a jerk. He's a really nice guy in real life, but man, he is the biggest jerk on the baseball field because he has to be, right? Because of the expectations he had to be. And I'm sure Pete Rose is the same way. He had to be a jerk on the field. And I'm sure sometimes it carries over off the field to some degree with their personality. I'm sure that was probably part of the problem with his gambling addiction as well.
I agree. I think one key understanding for me that I came to early in my reporting is that Pete Rose succeeds as a player and fails as a man for the same reasons. He plays with that fury on the field. He goes to extremes. He will not be vulnerable on the field. He will not bend or break to anyone. And just as important, guys, Pete Rose is an eternal optimist, which was an asset.
Gotta be if you're gonna gamble.
it was an asset to him as a player. What's the line from Bull Durham? Don't think, it can only hurt the ball club, right?
Right.
Pete Rose is not thinking. He believes all the time that he's going to succeed. He is that confidence bordering on arrogance is an asset to him as a player. But all those things, his unwillingness to be vulnerable, his unwillingness to bend, his enduring belief that he will prevail, he will get out of this, are the same reasons why he's going to go down for his gambling. The same exact reasons.
Wow. So I thought that the release of this book was unfortunately very timely, given the Shohei Ohtani gambling.
Fortunately, scandal. Unfortunate?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it could really help.
It helps the sales for sure. I'm sure it does. But can you give us your opinion on the Ohtani thing?
Yeah. My gosh. We timed it to come out, of course, around opening day. So that was intentional. And no one would have ever predicted that we would have come out right in the teeth of what is undeniably baseball's biggest gambling scandal since the Pete Rose scandal. But in other ways, it's not that surprising. In one of my first interviews almost 3 years ago, with a man you guys will remember, and a man many of your viewers and listeners will remember, was with Faye Vincent, the deputy commissioner of baseball under Bart Giamatti in 1989, and then the commissioner of baseball who succeeds Giamatti. And in one of those very first interviews at the time, in late 2021, Faye was looking out over the landscape of how the world had changed and the legalization of gambling, baseball's partnerships with legal gambling platforms. And Faye said that, there's going to be more Pete Roses and there's going to be more corruption. It's only a matter of time. And as soon as the Shohei scandal broke and the controversy broke, that was the first thing I thought of, that line that Faye had effectively predicted. Something like this. And, you know, let's be, you know, upfront. We don't know what we don't know about Shohei Ohtani and his now former interpreter and an alleged legal bookie and alleged payments, you know, of millions of dollars to covering gambling debts. We have no idea, honestly. But there are some important parallels here. You know, Pete Rose gets in trouble in the 80s, not for something he's doing initially, but for something the men around him are doing. You know, he has an inner circle of guys who are engaging in all kinds of behavior that attracts the attention of federal authorities in Cincinnati, the FBI. And just as there's a federal investigation happening in Southern California right now, there was a federal investigation in Ohio. And one by one, these men in Ohio start to turn on each other and they start to talk. And that talk and those turns gets the attention of the press, who starts to write about it. And that forces Major League Baseball's hand and they have to investigate. So, you know, the circumstances are 100% different and we don't know what we don't know. But there's a lot of familiarities there. You know, there is a federal investigation in Southern California right now, and the press is digging into it. And that has forced Major League Baseball's hand. And it's just going to be very interesting to see what happens next now. You know, what is our appetite for a gambling investigation in 2024? You know, is Major League Baseball going to go to the mat on this in the way they did in 1989? There is so much that we don't know. But there's a lot that's out of baseball's hands. You know, one of the key things that happened in 89 was the bookie in question gets in federal trouble, faces federal charges, and decides to say everything, talk to everybody, tell everything. And, you know, if something like that happened here again, Major League Baseball loses control of this narrative, and so too does Shohei Ohtani and his former interpreter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be crazy to watch this thing unfold with the investigation that's going. Okay, last thing we have for you. Pete Rose has a lifetime ban from baseball, which in turn, lifetime ban from the Hall of Fame. Do you think he gets in posthumously? Do you think he gets in after he dies? Or is it going to be forever and ever, no Pete Rose in the Hall? No plaque.
Yeah. So if I'm going to speculate here, just as a fan, I think, and if I had to, since we're talking about gambling, if I had to bet my house on it, I would bet no. I would bet that he never got in. And I'm not suggesting that that's what I personally believe should happen. I'm just saying, I wonder who will be advocating for him when he is gone. But one thing, you know, I think can, you know, move the needle in a different way. And I do think it's everything we just discussed. I think it is the current gambling landscape. I think it is potentially what happens in this investigation in California. I think it is the next scandal that's coming for the next player. One thing I can say, since the book has come out and I've met readers and fans in town after town, is that fans, you know, have a trouble reconciling the fact that Pete Rose is banned forever for gambling, and that gambling is now so prevalent and, in fact, encouraged now by baseball itself. Obviously, there's not an equality to both Pete's sins and the current landscape. And by that, I mean, right, a player would still be banned, right, if they did it.
But
fans have a problem with that. Fans I've met have a problem with the fact that they're watching these games and baseball's begging us to bet on them.
Yeah. And we even have people on YouTube who are like, well, why can't they bet on themselves to win? Why can't they bet on themselves for the over? It's like, no, because you're manipulating the outcome of the game by doing something. Like, you can't even go anywhere near it. And so, it's a whole thing, and it's crazy. Because you get Pete Rose in, you got to get Shoeless Joe in, and then it's a whole thing, man. It's crazy. It's just nuts.
It is crazy. It's for 35 years, it's been the great late night sports bar debate. It remains the great late night sports bar debate. You know, people who argue their side feel it 100%. You know, no one is on the fence about Pete Rose.
And I will say, I experienced a little bit more nuance lately with the Ohtani thing, because I'm like, you can't kick Ohtani out regardless, you know?
Right.
It's crazy. So I can feel a little bit more of what people say with Pete Rose, seeing it, an investigation with Ohtani. So,
yeah, I can see the betrayal and the advocacy and both, like, the apologetics side, and it's all starting to become more relevant for us with the Ohtani thing. And thank you for helping us with your book, because now we have all of the nuance that we've missed for years.
Well,
and
thank you.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I wanted to tell everybody that not only can you get Keith's book at anywhere, but you can get a signed copy, right, from Water Street Bookstores. Did I see that right?
Yeah, Water Street Bookstore in Exeter, New Hampshire is my local independent bookseller. And, you know, I live just a short drive away, and I go in on a regular basis and sign books. And so, yeah, if you want a signed copy, you're not going to find me out on the road. You can always order it through Water Street. You want a, you know, a personal gift for your dad or your brother or your grandfather or your son, you know, just note in the sales form how you want it inscribed, and I'll do that. And then Water Street will ship it out to you. It'll arrive like magic.
Yeah, magic. we say automagically. Awesome. Well, Keith, thanks for being here with us. We appreciate it. And baseball family, we'll be right back.
Baseball family, I hope you enjoyed that interview. And by I mean we both, I can speak on Briggs' behalf on this part. But we hope you enjoyed that interview. We loved talking to Keith O'Brien. We highly recommend his book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. It is an excellent read. Super interesting. Reads really, really fast. Like you said, short chapters for a reason. You'll buzz right through it. It's outstanding. Go pick it up wherever you can. We will put a link in the description so you can go get your own copy of it and read it like we did. Loved it. Absolutely amazing. But before I go, don't forget to hop on schnookseedery.com. Use code BTPOD at checkout to save 10% off your order. You will support the show while supporting yourself and supporting your mouth by getting the best seeds ever. Like, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you can. It helps the show, helps us to grow. Tell your friends about the show if you have not already. And make sure you tune in every week. We drop new episodes every Tuesday, and we go live every Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. You can catch that here on YouTube. You can catch it on Facebook, on the Facebook group as well. But baseball family, thank you so much for joining me this week. We will catch you Thursday night.